Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insider's insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, has President Obama capitulated by putting Social Security on the cutting block? What is the future of Social Security? Then, both the Koch brothers and Rupert Murdoch are potential suitors for the newspaper division of the Tribune Company, which owns 8 newspapers, including the Los Angeles Times, the Baltimore Sun, the Orlando Sentinel, and the Chicago Tribune. We'll explore the fast-changing world of journalism and media and what it means for governance and democracy. Progressive congressional representatives, including John Conyers and Senator Bernie Sanders, are calling for an in-person meeting with President Obama to challenge any cuts to Social Security benefits. More than 100 House Democrats have also signed a letter that opposes proposed changes to calculations for Social Security benefits called chained CPI. What is the future for Social Security in the U.S.? Michael Hilsig joins us. Michael Hilsig is a columnist at the Los Angeles Times and the author of numerous books, including The Plot Against Social Security, How the Bush Plan is Endangering Our Financial Future, and The New Deal, A Modern History. Welcome, Michael Hilsig. Great to have you back with us.
It's delightful to be back.
I wanted to understand what exactly is going on with the Social Security debate. You've written the book, The Plot Against Social Security. You looked at the Republican efforts to dismantle the program. Remind us what happened.
Well, if you're talking about what's happened recently, obviously President Obama has put into his budget a provision that represents a real benefit cut to retirees, in fact, everybody on Social Security, by using a different formula to calculate the annual cost of living adjustment. It's a formula that measures inflation at a slower rate than the formula that has been used. And although the claim is that this is, quote, more accurate, there's no evidence that it is more accurate. It's just different. And what's obvious is that it's lower.
Historically, this has been quite a battle by the Republican Party, especially the Bush administration, to cut Social Security. And now we have a Democratic president who has reconfigured numbers. What are the politics of this?
Sure. Well, the politics seem to be that President Obama wants, as his legacy, to reach a grand bargain on the federal budget or on the federal deficit. And I think his idea is that by giving what looks on the surface to be a very modest concession on Social Security, he would be able to extract from the Republicans more concessions on things like taxes so that there'd be more revenue. There are a lot of people on the progressive side who thought this is a huge mistake for one reason, that the Republicans simply aren't going to come to the table to compromise, and that the sort of concession that President Obama is making on Social Security, and in fact he's making other concessions on Medicare, are exactly what the Republicans have wanted to do, and that is begin to disengage Social Security as a universal program for everybody that really is reliable from the consciousness of Americans. And the more that you do that, the more you let people know that, oh, well, it is always subject to being tweaked or changed, the less credibility the program has, and that does real damage to the progressive ideal that Social Security and Medicare represent.
And so there really is a risk to the program.
I think there's a very definite risk to the program, leaving aside the fact that this is a more significant change in benefits than the president or the Republicans would want to let on. The fact of the matter is that the moment you put Social Security on the table, especially since it is not really relevant to the budget deficit, the more you open the door to much, much more mischief and damage.
Now, you had asked more or less in the article that you published in the Los Angeles Times about why do people go to such great lengths to, quote, deprive Granny and Grandpa of $30 a month? Why do they want to cut this so badly?
We understand why Republicans and conservatives want to cut it so badly. They didn't agree with the enactment of Social Security in 1935. They still don't like it. They think their shibboleth is that every individual should be responsible for his or her retirement, and the fact that that's not easy and that we all have a shared responsibility for everybody doesn't really register. So we know why they do it, why President Obama does it, and why the Democrats in Congress seem to be inclined to go along. I think they've drunk the Kool-Aid, so to speak, that what they call entitlements, and this is a real misnomer and it's real mischief in itself, are a part of the federal budget crisis. I don't agree, and I think most progressives don't agree, that there really is a crisis, and that this is the place where you have to go to cut. They don't want to raise taxes on the wealthy because, in fact, they've gotten to the point where the wealthy are, to a great extent, the Democratic constituency or the party's constituency as much as it's the Republicans' constituency. They don't want to cut defense because that's sort of the last line in the sand for all politicians in Washington. Everybody's got a defense industry in his or her district. So what's left are people who really have no voice in Congress and don't have any political power, and that's the elderly, the sick, and the poor.
Now, in this article, you also said that the fear that is being generated around these issues is based on what you called junk economics. Why do you call it junk economics?
Those of your listeners who've been following the debate know that the whole idea that we face a national debt crisis, it's bogus, but it had, at least until last week or the week before, a sort of veneer of academic bedrock, and that was a paper that had been written by two Harvard economists. One was not at Harvard when the paper was written, but she since moved there, Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart. And this paper purported to show through very sophisticated econometric modeling that when countries got to the point where their national debt was 90% of their gross domestic product or higher, then economic growth in those countries essentially fell off a cliff, that the 90% level was a real inflection point and a real crisis point. Now, they came out with this paper in 2010, and the reason it was taken up so eagerly, especially by conservatives, was that the United States level, the ratio of debt to GDP, was approaching 90% at that very time. And if you wanted to be a deficit hawk, you could point to this paper and say, look, even at Harvard, they agree that now that we're at 90%, our economic growth is going to come to a screeching halt. Well, what happened over the last week or 10 days is that a group of researchers at the University of Massachusetts went back and redid the math in this paper. In fact, they got from Rogoff and Reinhart their basic data, which those two authors had been resisting putting out for many years. They redid all the calculations, and what they discovered was that there were serious arithmetic and coding errors in the data, that Reinhart and Rogoff had missed adding certain countries to their averages when they put them into an Excel spreadsheet. They had left out certain years of high debt and high growth for certain countries. And then when you put it all together, their projection that this 90% ratio led to negative economic growth was dead wrong. And in fact, there was still significant growth even at those levels, and that the differences at 90% and at 50% were not statistically significant. So here you now had this economic paper that everybody from Tim Geithner to the Republicans in Congress would point to it during the debate on the deficit. We now know that they were wrong, that that wasn't so. They've defended their errors. They've tried to say that it doesn't matter, that their thesis is right. But clearly now, if you look at the numbers, they were dead wrong. And that all of this panic over the deficit was based on, as I said, bogus economics. And that really goes back to the question of, well, if you're talking about making these changes in Social Security benefits because of this deficit crisis, well, now you can see that the whole idea was based on basically not academic fraud, but a huge academic error.
You know, what's interesting about that is that it wasn't caught in the peer review process in the first publication, and it wasn't until these numbers were redone.
Let me just say, this paper, in fact, was not peer-reviewed. It appeared in a peer-reviewed economic journal, but it appeared in a section that was actually not peer-reviewed. First of all, nobody looked at the basic data because they didn't provide it. And second of all, one of the problems with the paper that might have been caught in peer review, but obviously never was that the basic thesis that this high debt-to-GDP ratio leads to economic downturns or slow economic growth had been questioned for many years by economists who read the paper, because what they showed at best, even if you accepted their numbers, was that there was an association between high debt to GDP ratios and low economic growth, but they couldn't show that the cause didn't go the other way. In other words, it was because a country had low economic growth that its debt-to-GDP ratio began to rise. In other words, it wasn't that debt caused the slowdown, but the slowdown caused the debt. And that's, in fact, much more likely, because if you have an economic slump, your GDP shrinks, so the mathematical formula begins to show a higher ratio of debt. And you're also going in and borrowing more because you want to stimulate the economy, as we did in the United States, though not as much as we had to. So there were always academic critics of this paper, but nobody was in a position to say, you didn't even do the math right.
We saw one of the graduate students on some of the comedy channels, Comedy Central, actually talking about this. He was the one that caught the errors. Do you remember the countries they were wrong on?
Well, they got a lot of countries wrong, and they were also criticized for a very peculiar process of waiting. They had New Zealand. New Zealand had 5 or 6 years, in reality, post-war years, of high debt to GDP. In most of those years, in fact, New Zealand's economic growth was quite healthy. They didn't code most of those years. They only used one, which was a year in which economic growth was very slow. But as it turns out, the reason economic growth was slow in that year in New Zealand was because there was a huge general strike that affected the ports. And we know that economic growth was slow, but we know the reason, and it did not have anything to do with debt. And yes, in the coding error, they managed to leave out countries like Canada, Australia, I think other years for New Zealand, maybe the UK. And the years that they left off did reflect higher growth in years of high debt. If you put it all together, what the UMass people found is that, although Reinhart and Rogoff said that, that in their database, when you were at 90%, you had negative 0.1% growth. In fact, when UMass redid the calculations, they said when you have 90%, you still have something in the neighborhood of positive 2.9% growth. And that's not statistically different from what you have when you're below 90%.
I think it was 100 Democrats that have signed a letter asking Obama to reconsider this. Given all of that, do you see this actually going through? And if so, what will be the impact?
If you're talking about the change in the cost of living calculation, I think that there is, and this is, I think, gratifying for those of us who follow politics, there has been a significant pushback on this idea. And I think the fact that we now have this mathematical error in the background, there's going to be more pushback. I think the chained CPI, which is the new formula that Obama has proposed using, is a mistake. It's bad policy. It does not actually do much to make Social Security any healthier. For the people who are directly affected by it, Social Security retirees, half of them get more than 90% of their income in retirement from Social Security, this could be a real blow. It's going to make a material difference in their lives. And I think, in a certain way, the Republicans have played to form. They have not moved on this. So even to the extent that Obama made this offer, it hasn't been taken up. And I think in the fullness of time, one would hope, and it looks like this may happen, he's going to withdraw it, and he should.
Well, Michael Hiltzik, thank you once again for being with us, and it's always a pleasure.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Michael Hiltzik is a columnist at the Los Angeles Times and the author of numerous books, including The Plot Against Social Security, How the Bush Plan is Endangering Our Financial Future, and The New Deal, A Modern History. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. The so-called Fourth Estate has been rapidly changing, both in style and in substance. Among the developments, a number of newspapers have been shutting their doors and facing bankruptcy and leaving a void in some important civic information. One media company, the Tribune Company, which owns 8 newspapers, including the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, and the Baltimore Sun, is selling off its newspaper properties. Among its suitors are the Koch brothers and Rupert Murdoch. What do these changes mean for their audiences and for Democratic governance? Tom Rosensteel is with us. He's an author, journalist, and media critic. He's the executive director of the American Press Institute and the founder of the Center for Excellence in Journalism. His many books include The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect, and Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. Welcome, Tom Rosensteel. Great to have you back with us.
Good to be here.
What are the details at this point? What do we know about the Tribune newspapers and the potential suitors and who might be buying those properties?
Well, at this point, you rarely know much. Much of what is reported tends to be rumor, but there are some who are on the record as expressing interest. That list now includes the Koch brothers. Rupert Murdoch, News Corp, has been rumored to be interested at the Newspaper Association convention a week ago. The owner of the Orange County Register, who is new to the newspaper industry and is investing in that paper, has also announced that he and his investors would be interested in all of the Tribune papers. They're an interesting group because they are making a heavy bet on print and digital subscriptions and sort of believe in the long term that newspapers have a growth future.
There have been some articles that have articulated concern. I think the one in The Nation actually said four reasons you should worry about a potential Coke takeover. Would you agree, first of all, that there are reasons to worry? And how much impact would it make if it were, say, somebody from the Orange County Register or a Rupert Murdoch?
Well, local media are very different than national media in their economic structure and the way they operate. For instance, you should note that Fox News Corp. Owns a variety of local news channels, local TV channels around the country that do news, and they have even a larger number of affiliates. Those channels, by and large, do not follow the model of Fox News on cable. And the reason is pretty simple. If you're a local TV news channel, you need a large part of the market share to be competitive. And if you begin with an ideological point of view and essentially lop off half or more of your markets from wanting to watch you, you start at such an economic disadvantage that you can't compete. So it doesn't make economic sense to be ideological. Local newspapers fall into that category. Most markets have only one newspaper in town. And if the newspaper starts out by antagonizing the market ideologically, it really puts what is an embattled industry at an even weaker position. There's research that shows that newspapers tend to reflect the ideology of their market, not just in their editorial pages, but in the vernacular that they use and in the selection of stories. And news in general really doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from a particular community. So the Los Angeles is a fairly liberal community compared to the rest of the country. If the Koch brothers came in and tried to make the news pages and everything else about the paper libertarian in some way that they reflected, let's say, the Cato Institute or other magazine publications that they may have been involved with, the risk financially to the enterprise and the ease of someone starting up an alternative publication today, I think it just doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, that may also mean that they're not ultimately going to end up being the buyer. But there isn't any example today where one newspaper city thrives with an ideological publication.
For years, you were in charge of the state of the news media over at the Pew Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism, and it seems like the role of newspapers has been declining. What are the trends that you see in terms of media?
Well, newspapers have lost 40% of their revenue overall. Total revenue from newspapers is down 40% since the beginning of 2000. That's a significant loss. Newsrooms have shrunk by about 28% to 30%. Big city newspapers have been hit harder than smaller newspapers because they tended to compete more for national and international news where there are other alternatives, and they're in markets where the digital disruption to the revenue side tends to be bigger. Retailers are maybe more online than they are in small towns. So for all the obvious reasons, newspapers have been hit very hard. And classified advertising was hit the hardest because what was a pay sector, people paying for classified, became free on Craigslist and the audience migrated. So 75 to 80% of classified advertising that was in newspapers at the beginning of 2000 is now gone. There are signs that the newspaper business is beginning to belatedly adapt. Circulation revenue grew in 2012 for the first time in a decade. Why? Because papers were beginning to successfully convert to digital subscriptions. There are about 450 newspapers now that have some kind of metered digital subscription or paywall, such as the New York Times is the most obvious success in that. But papers all over, large and small, are moving that way and having success. We also see about $3 billion in revenue in newspapers that didn't in 2012 that didn't exist a couple of years ago in e-commerce. This is not advertising per se, but it may be coupons that you get on your mobile phones and other kinds of information that goes directly to consumers. But a lot of people believe that the real growth for local publishers is going to be in this e-commerce space, particularly as mobile becomes more and more part of our lives. You walk into the store with a mobile phone, you look at a product, and you say, gee, I wonder if I can get something this somewhere else for cheaper. And if you're a subscriber to a local newspaper or other news organization, you may have a coupon that will allow you to buy that product right there in that store for less. Even then, if none of those really come to fruition, if there were not at the beginning of a turnaround for newspapers, the largest news organization in every market where there's a newspaper is the newspaper. There's more reporters at the LA Times today, by far, than there are at all the local television stations and radio stations combined. And that phenomenon is true pretty much everywhere. So newspapers, while much smaller than they were a decade ago, by about 30% in terms of newsroom, are still the dominant news organizations in terms of their ability to gather and find out what's going on in the community.
You've been somewhat critical of how content is changing. What would you say the major trends are there?
You know, the problem I think the newspapers have had, as have all publishers, is that they think that when their revenue is shrinking, they should then just shrink the newsroom. Disproportionately, newsrooms have probably taken a bigger hit than other parts of publishing. I think that's misguided, because if you can save money on other costs and you're going to start to turn to charge the consumer more with digital subscriptions, you need to improve this product. You need to give people a reason to buy your news. And simply kind of managing costs as a long-term strategy is a spiral to oblivion. Now, part of improving your product also means understanding the new way that audiences behave. We wake up in the morning with the internet in our pocket or by our bedstand. People are checking their mobile phones when they wake up. They're on desktops during the day in the office. They're on mobile, particularly tablets. Tablet consumption is heaviest between 8 and 11 and starts to spike up about 5 p.m. So the tablet is a kind of device that's sort of halfway between print and digital. You touch it, and people are interacting long form with tablets. Publishers are going to have to figure out the rhythms of how people get the news, because people no longer adapt their behavior to news. The news has to adapt its delivery to people's behavior.
There was something that you had said in a previous book, finding that there was less of an incentive to get the facts right.
You know, in a world where there's a fair amount of news that's readily available everywhere, which the term for this now is commodity news. That's not news that's about commodities, but it's news that's so undistinguished that itself it is a commodity. You see more and more publishers looking to what can we offer that people cannot find somewhere else. For local publishers, that tends to be, well, we can do local things that no one else can do. But I think that there's a notion increasingly that beyond the headline, beyond the initial iterative a blast of information, people need the news to sort of make connections for them. They need context, depth, history. And so it's possible that going deeper rather than going faster may be part of the future of where news publishing has to go, even to the extent that you see publishers now saying, well, at 9 in the morning, we'll give people a couple of sentences about this, and then we'll stop trying to cover this bit by bit through the day, and we'll work on a story that we can deliver about 5 o'clock in the afternoon that actually goes deeper, provide things that people think have value and that they cannot find anywhere else, if particularly you're going to start charging them for it.
And so now when you take a look at what is in the news, for example, we had, you know, the Boston bombing, and it was an incredible amount of news. Do you have a sense that there's enough news to cover all the other things that are important as well? Or do you see that there's this kind of competition to grab eyeballs that makes it hard to do that?
Yeah, and this is a big problem. I mean, this is not a new problem. News organizations have all tended to flock to the big story forever because it's the easiest way to get eyeballs. You know, you want to be in the conversation that everybody's having. That is antithetical to this idea, well, let's do the things that we can do best and borrow or curate the rest. I think to some degree, serious traditional news providers, newspapers probably as a band of brothers and sisters first, are going to kind of need to look at each other as collaborators rather than competitors. It is a way to say, well, let's pool our resources and do and provide better quality news so that we're not replicating. The news industry has a history of this on some rare occasions where it's been under attack. In war zones, certainly reporters have long done this, where they sort of cover for each other, even on campaigns where reporters are sort of running in a pack trying to cover more candidates than they can actually cover. There's been a fair amount of sharing. So at the reporter level, it's not unheard of. From the consumer's point of view, it's a great thing. Why should I have 25 accounts of the same thing that are essentially the president going out and making remarks without taking questions? You know, when I'd rather have the rest of you off doing other things, and I'm one or two accounts of that press conference is sufficient.
Finally, at the beginning when we were talking about the potential suitors for the Tribune newspapers, and you mentioned that the News Corp's local properties are not really the same as Fox News, the national channel. If you look internationally at the majority of News Corporation's properties, and I'm reminiscing a little bit to an interview I saw with one of Rupert Murdoch's close colleagues who said, you know, he personally really enjoys the salacious. He personally really enjoys the gossip. And it seems like that has been part of what has driven the eyeballs to News Corporation. Do you see some of that seeping into the local material? Or, you know, can you compare the...
Well, you know, it's interesting. Murdoch was a failure in the American newspaper industry for most of his life on the soil. And the reason was that the tabloid newspaper that thrives in England and in some other countries is gone in the U.S. It was replaced by local television. This is something that Murdoch did not understand. So he at one time owned seven newspapers around the country, including the New York Post and the Boston Herald and papers elsewhere in Texas and other places. And he did not succeed with them. He has owned on and off the New York Post, but it is not a money-making venture for him. When he bought the Wall Street Journal, it was a different enterprise. And it was not a tabloid newspaper, and he did not try and make it into one. This just is a fact of life. We have, unlike in Europe, where we have a lot of national papers that are small and tend to be ideological because you have parliamentary systems with multi-parties, in the U.S., where you have one newspaper in most towns, and advertisers want that newspaper to be as respectable a space as it can be, that tends to drive papers towards the middle. And even Murdoch's record in the U.S. suggests that that is a kind of a gravitational pull that is very hard to buck, because advertisers operate by a sort of industry-wide thinking, and it's very hard to say, well, we're going to operate very just differently in this town. For better or for worse, ironically, advertising over the last century proved to be a source of making the news less ideological, because advertisers were renting the moderate respectability of the media space. That's why the number one advertisers on local TV tend to be car dealers, because they want to rent the respectability and popularity of the newscaster.
Tom Rosensteel, thank you so much for being with us again.
My pleasure, as always.
Tom Rosensteel is with us. He's an author, journalist, and media critic. He's the executive director of the American Press Institute and the founder of the Center for Excellence in Journalism. His many books include The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect, and Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. More on what these rapid changes in mass media mean up next on the Scholar Circle. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we've been talking about the changes that are occurring in mass media and what they mean for governance and for society. Three experts on mass media and communication join us now. James T. Hamilton is a professor of public policy, economics, and political science and the director of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy. He's the author of All the News That's Fit to Sell, How the Market Transforms Information into News, and Channeling Violence, the Economic Market for Violent Television Programming. Ben Compain is director of the Fellows Program at Columbia University Institute for Teleinformation and lecturer at the DeMore McKim School of Business at Northeastern University. He's the author of The Digital Divide, Who Owns the Media, and The Internet Upheaval. Victor Picard is a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is co-editor of Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? And was a lead author for Saving the News Toward a National Journalism Strategy. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. Potential for the Koch brothers or Rupert Murdoch to buy the Tribune, which I believe owns seven major newspapers, within the context of the changes that have been going on with journalism. The Pew Center has reported that resources are dwindling, news media is increasingly unable to uncover stories or dig deep into emerging ones. What are the trends that we're seeing in addition to this, and what does all of this really mean for citizens, audiences, and for U.S. politics? Jay Hamilton?
One reason you wouldn't be surprised that the Koch brothers might want to buy newspapers is that the price of newspapers has gone down radically in the last 10 years. And so if they were thinking about trying to buy a newspaper as a business proposition, the price of the newspaper has gone down. And if they were thinking about it as a way to perhaps exert some influence on the public debate, the price of their ideological expression has gone down too.
When you say the price of their ideological expression has gone down, that is because?
Because it's easier, it's cheaper to buy newspaper companies. If you look back, say, to the 1980s, there were two industries in the U.S. where family or individual ownership was predominant, media companies and sports franchises. And in both of those industries, people got a sort of psychic income for playing a role in their community. And with the price of newspapers going down, in part because of the revenues going down, if you wanted to buy a newspaper in part to impart your worldviews to others, the price of that is going down.
Victor Picard, let's bring you in. Would you agree with that assessment? And what else do you see?
I 100% agree with Jay's analysis here. And just to give another concrete example of similar phenomenon with the devaluation of newspapers here in Philadelphia. The Philadelphia newspapers sold for $55 million a year ago. They went for $460 million more dollars back in 2006. So that's a radical devaluation. They're definitely becoming much more affordable for especially wealthy individuals like the Koch brothers to purchase. But to just back up a little bit, I think to ask why newspapers are becoming so devalued, it really traces back to a fundamental flaw with their business model, namely their reliance on advertising revenue. As readers and advertisers migrate to the internet, where digital ads pay pennies to the dollar of traditional paper-based advertising, their advertising revenue is plummeting, which is leading to fewer and fewer news-related jobs. You had mentioned the Pew Research Center earlier. They found that there's about 30% declines in the reporting and editing capacity at American newspapers since 2000. So I think that's one of the larger issues that we should discuss in terms of the implications of what's happening with this gradual collapse of the newspaper industry.
Yeah, that's exactly what I want to get into. And maybe something that will preface that is really how much does ownership matter on content? Ben Compain, that's something that you look at. What do you think?
That's a good point, because there's always this perception that owners, especially the old family owners, the Sulzbergers and the McCormicks of old, as I think Jay said, enjoyed the influence or the perceived influence. And yet, study after study has shown very little influence of newspapers. There's the editorial page, which most people never read in the first place, and the impact of editorials has always been, in research terms, sort of iffy. Most newspapers have avoided having opinions, at least very, very blatant, on the news pages, and when they have, it's at their own peril. In my last book or last research, I looked at 17 studies that concluded that there are very few differences in editorials, whether or not it's owned by groups or by individuals. A major research study that came out a couple years ago from a couple of economists at the University of Chicago found that owners had far less impact on what the editorial slant of the newspaper was than the consumers in the areas in which they published. That is, they found in general terms that newspapers in what we call red states tended to be slightly more conservative than newspapers in blue states, regardless of their owners, even if the same owners. And that is, the newspaper tends to slightly reflect the interests of the consumers rather than the other way around.
That's a chicken and egg question, and I think that's something Jay Hamilton has also looked at. You've looked at it from the perspective of what people want versus what they need being provided in newspapers. What would you say to this?
I would agree with Ben that audience interest is one of the paramount drivers in newspaper content on the news pages. But if you think about that Chicago study, what they showed was that if you're in a state where people use the word death tax rather than inheritance tax, death tax is going to be more likely to be used in the newspaper. Whereas if you're in a state where politicians talk about the inheritance tax is the word that's going to be used. Objectivity has been a commercial product and came about in the U.S. press around the 1870s when you had the invention of very expensive high-speed presses. And in order to spread the cost of that press around, people stopped being the Democratic or the Republican paper. They became the independent paper because they could get a lot more readers and sell those people to advertisers. What the decline in the advertising value of a newspaper means is that for somebody like the Koch brothers, if they did decide that they wanted to have a more slanted paper that went against audience demand, the cost to them would be lower because there's less revenue from advertising coming in now.
Victor, let's go to the point that you bring up, that there may be a consequence to this. What do you think that is?
Aside from these questions about ideology and bias in journalistic coverage, we also should look at just the role of newspapers, which are really the last bastion of actual journalism.
What about radio?
I'm sorry. Of course, radio, there's some fantastic radio journalism still going on. But increasingly, newspapers are providing a lot of kind of raw materials for the rest of the media ecosystem. And there was a study, again, by the Pew Research Center in Baltimore in 2009. The report came out in 2010 that looked at a week of media coverage in Baltimore. They were looking at everything, both old and new media, including newspapers, radio, television, blogs, even Twitter dispatches. And they found that despite what seemed like this proliferation of media, most of the news that people received did not contain original reporting. They found that old media, like, for example, the Baltimore Sun, was still generating more than 95% of original news stories. So this gives you a sense of the importance, the centrality of even these suffering newspapers for the larger ecosystem. Because the same study found that the Baltimore Sun was at a fraction of its capacity of where it had been 10 or 20 years ago. So I think this raises a number of concerns.
Ben Compain.
All this is true. The problem is there's not much we can do about it. We can talk about and wring our hands at the declining revenue of newspapers and therefore fewer resources. And I think that's right, that much of what we see in other media is still being originated with newspapers. And we haven't yet developed a model to replace that. And I think we're still in the early stages. Something is going to have to develop. One of my concerns is this notion of be careful what you wish for, because for decades we were wishing for greater diversity and ownership, more media sources. We only had three TV networks, and most cities had one or two newspapers. And now we have this huge division of our attention, for good or bad, but that means that no one source, including broadcasters, television broadcasters, is dominant and therefore has the resources that they had in the past. And we haven't put together a new model to replace that.
Well, that brings up another point, which is this potential balkanization of audiences or polarization of audiences who only go to one set of sources and never hear the other side. If they're just Fox News listeners or just MSNBC listeners, what does that do to our electorate?
This is Ben. That's sort of what I was just trying to get to. And you're right that I think both our personal experience as well as the research says that Fox News is watched primarily by people who agree and like what they hear on Fox News and MSNBC. And we've always had that. People who bought the New Republic or the National Review had that frame of reference, but they were also watching the CBS Evening News or reading their local newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer or whatever. And today, that's not happening as much, and I think we're getting more and more stovepiped.
Well, Jay Hamilton, let's go back to you for a moment here, because you've done a lot about how the market really affects the media content. And one of the things you looked at was violence, for example, and we just saw the Boston bomber being covered in a particular way across its seemingly most media. Can you give us a sense of why we're seeing this?
I actually think that there are a couple of, believe it or not, public policy levers that we could use, even though I'm a very strong believer in the First Amendment. The things that we've been talking about often been problems of demand. Are people strongly interested enough in public affairs stories so that they would be covered? But there are a couple of things that the government could do right now to make it more likely that stories about government accountability journalism would be told. And one of them deals with IRS and tax policy. If you look over the last couple of years, you've seen local outlets which are nonpartisan that are trying to form and cover what could be called broccoli journalism, stories about schools and the environment and community development. You have MinnPost, Voice of San Diego, St. Louis Beacon. And what the IRS has started to do is slow down the approval of those nonprofit local public affairs websites. So while it's good to focus on what the market is giving you, there are a set of people who are saying, you know what, the market is not going to tell the local accountability journalism stories in my area. I'd like to form something that would tell it. And so far, the government has made that harder rather than easier.
So local accountability stories would be one aspect that's missing from media, perhaps because of market forces, if we look at your model. I'm guessing there are a lot of other things that are missing. Victor Picard.
Yeah, we know that there are quite a few gaps that are emerging in news coverage. Local stories, also international stories, especially as foreign bureaus are dismantled due to cost-cutting measures. You also see stories at the state level covering state governments are going increasingly unreported. I agree with Jay that there are a number of things that the government could do to try to correct for what could be seen as a kind of market failure to support the public service mission of journalism. In addition to tweaking tax laws to help new startups, the government could also make it easier for existing news organizations to transition into nonprofit or low-profit status. And also the question of subsidies needs to come up. It's often a very delicate subject within American political discourse, not nearly so in other democracies. We should start thinking about in various creative ways to provide public subsidies for, in my preference, it would be for nonprofit journalistic ventures. It's something that we should at least have on the table.
The San Diego Tribune is kind of an example where a conservative owner came in and started to move its ideology more and more towards his bent, and people had nowhere else to go. How much would it change the overall media ecosystem, to use Victor's word, if we had somebody like the Koch brothers or the Murdochs really take these, say, something like the Tribune or more newspapers? Would it start to change the ideology more? Ben Compain.
Of course, it's a factor. There's no ideological litmus test for purchasing or starting or running any media organization. The only thing you can look at is whether or not there's any monopoly or tendency to monopolize concentration. So to that extent, there's almost nothing you can do about it. Personally, I'm not very concerned about this because there are lots of places to go. Most newspapers have been losing circulation as it is. My guess is if some radical left or right wing, whatever ideologue bought a major newspaper and permeated the whole paper with it, that would just accelerate the decline, except for the small hardcore that may like that. I think that Jay said that the cost of doing that is much less than a few years ago, but also the result of that would be much less because, again, you'd be talking to the choir. If someone wants to try that, let them try that. It probably will cost them a lot of money, and they'll probably have minimal influence. And it also perhaps leaves a hole for someone else to come along and say, look, you know, San Diego or whoever doesn't have a mainstream newspaper. We can start one for 3 days a week or something, and also at low cost. So there are different ways that that could go.
I'd also like to look at the internet now and how that and social media are changing this entire media landscape. Jay Hamilton, you've talked a bit about this in your work. How do you see the effects?
One thing that the internet and social media has done in some sense is that it has lowered the cost of discovering some stories. Investigative reporters are starting to use Twitter as a way to follow some leads. And if you think about the prospects of what journalism could do if they had better tools and algorithms, right now, journalists are outmatched when they try to cover the government. The government has a lot of great software that watches us, and we have very imperfect tools to watch them, or even campaigns. If you think about the social media targeting and the targeting in email that the Obama campaign used. In the old days, newspapers and campaigns both used pollsters, so it was sort of equal when they were studying public opinion. And ProPublica has tried to use text mining of emails to discover what campaigns are doing. But I think one thing that could be done is, it's a clunky term called computational journalism, but if you could basically combine transparency and open government with better use of data and algorithms, you could lower the cost of telling accountability journalism stories.
Victor Picard.
I agree that the internet has created new potentials for disseminating news. And there have been some studies that actually show that more people are reading traditional print news, although online oftentimes, than ever before. But I think that the problem here is that we really haven't figured out a way to monetize news online in a way that could sustain jobs, that could sustain journalistic production to the capacity that our society requires. So I'm still not entirely optimistic about the future of digital journalism. There have been numerous measures. Probably the most well-known is what's known as the paywall, an online subscription model. And the New York Times and many news organizations are experimenting with various forms of this, which some have likened to a Hail Mary pass for the newspaper industry. But I'm actually in the middle of a study right now that's looking at the performance of paywalls. It's not concluded yet, but right now it seems that while they are generating some revenue and they're kind of able to tread water for a while, they're not making up for previous losses. And it's hard to see how this will be a sustainable model for the long term.
The internet has a positive and a negative aspect. One is when people do see something that they're interested in, they might dig a little bit deeper and they might find those sources. But the other is, it seems to me, there is a low cost to spreading false information.
Yep, this is Ben. Just the other day, some tweet sent the stock market way down for a few minutes, reporting this explosion or something at the White House. I forget.
Yeah, it was an alleged bomb at the White House, and Obama was hurt.
I tend to be a glass half full type of guy. I think in the history of literacy, from oral literacy to written literacy, conventions had to be developed over time to create trust. I won't go into it now, but things like indentures and red tape actually were techniques that helped give credibility to written documents at a time when oral records were still predominant. And I think we're early in this period of trying to find ways of authenticating and becoming, you might say, literate in the digital world. And we've only been at this for a decade or two, and I suspect we'll get there. In the meantime, there might be some problems.
Jay Hamilton, you've looked at this also. Is there a danger in the internet with this ability of anybody to post something and it being false?
It is the case that on the internet, it's very cheap to have a website. There are low cost to entry. And as Ben was saying, in the old days, one reason you might be accurate is that you had something at risk. It might have been the investment that you had. in your printing press or the reputation that you had. And so on the online world, you're going to have people with much less at risk, and it might lead them to be more inaccurate. In our discussion today, we've sort of talked about news in terms of being slanted or being inaccurate. And when I think of how news markets are changing, to me, a fundamental problem is stories that aren't told at all, in part because they're so costly. So I live in a town where the number of people in the newsroom has gone from 250 to 90 over the last 6 years. And there are whole parts of our metro area, both geographically and substantively, that no longer have beat reporters. So to me, the biggest market failure in the U.S. is that if you look at newspaper markets in the local area, there are simply things that they can't afford to cover, can't afford to have the expertise anymore. The New York Times is doing well because they can aggregate up the advertising and subscription of college-educated people around the U.S., but there is no New York Times of a place like Raleigh, North Carolina.
And then there's also the issue of not being able to cover international matters with any kind of a depth for a very similar reason, a financial reason.
That's right.
Victor Picard.
I agree. I think we were talking about this earlier about these, some people refer to as news deserts that are emerging in our media landscape. And again, I think we need to consider various forms of funding news, structural alternatives for funding news. And I mentioned subsidies, but just to give a couple more specific examples, one idea that's been proposed is that we repurpose some of the money that's currently used for funding international broadcasting, like Voice of America. There's $670 million that the U.S. puts toward international broadcasting every year. Just a fraction of that put towards kind of public media system, whether we want to repurpose our public broadcast system to maybe bring it more in line with the funding levels that other democracies devote towards their public media. That would be a huge step. There's another proposal out there that suggests that individuals could be given tax vouchers to put towards their choice of media. So there are ways to fund, to subsidize media that don't involve direct subsidies from the government that I think we should consider.
Well, let me just explore a couple of other models that I saw in other countries that I saw in Mexico and in France. There were a couple of journalism co-ops where journalists actually owned it together. I believe it was essentially nonprofit, so there wasn't the drive to have endless profits and make money for their shareholders so much. So they had to raise less money, just enough for the operation and to support themselves. Would something like that work in the U.S.? And I know it was tried in Chicago and didn't work. That might have been for other reasons. Jay Hamilton?
The Chicago News Co-op was interesting. That was one example where they had applied to the IRS for nonprofit status and had not received it by the time they went and ceased operation. I think that there are ways to try to encourage people to work for things other than profit maximization. So you do have some people who are willing to work for less than they would earn in the market. A lot of them try to work for these nonprofit news sites. Essentially, in the 80s and before, we were relying on one or two families in an area to not maximize profits, to tell stories that might not be the most profitable stories, but were important to the community. And with changes in the tax laws in the 1980s, you have the corporatization of newspapers where the responsibility now is to maximize returns to shareholders. But I do think across the country, you are seeing some experiments where people are saying, let's try to get together. And in some cities, it might be 10 or 12 people with a $1 million budget funded through philanthropy to try to tell the education or environment or growth stories that aren't being told by the local media.
We've been talking about news a lot, and I know news itself has a little bit of a bias. You know, it's got to be current. It's got to be not dog bites man, but man bites dog. That's sort of the unusual aspect of what's happening. It tends to be dramatic and event-oriented. But isn't there other information that is really important that perhaps should be covered, and does it have a chance? Ben Compain.
I forget who just mentioned that, but the stories that don't get told and the in-depth reporting in Philadelphia, Bartlett and Steele at the Inquirer used to churning out regular in-depth stories that weren't current news, but had to be told or were important stories. Those things will probably find ways of happening, a lot of them. I mean, there's never enough time or space to do everything that could be done. What I'm most concerned about, not so much are national stories. I think the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, a number of national organizations will be okay with that. Along with some of my colleagues, I think the real gap is going to be in local coverage. And while these various experiments, you know, let 100 flowers bloom, I mean, try co-ops, try philanthropy, which I think on the margin there might be some successes there. You know, ProPublica might be a model for some, but I don't think that's going to be the overall answer.
Victor Picard.
Yeah, well, I agree with Ben that we should let 100 flowers bloom here and just try to experiment, but we do have to find a way where we are supporting journalists to do those local stories, to do long-form investigative stories, and oftentimes the current market for news production just simply will not support these kinds of journalistic endeavors. So we really do need to find structural alternatives.
Jay Hamilton, I think for you, I have to also ask, is there a market for that?
If you're frustrated by what audience demand is giving you, one way to address it is to lower the cost of discovering or generating the story. So we haven't talked much about transparency and open government, but to the extent that a government makes data more available that allows you to hold it accountable, those stories are more likely to be told.
And final word, Ben Compain.
Well, as I said before, I'm an optimist. With everyone walking around with cameras on their phones or phones on their cameras, whichever, and tweeting, we have lots of eyes out. It's going to be harder, I think, for lots of things to get hidden. I think the important stuff is still going to get out, but it might be in different ways, and this is going to evolve. We haven't seen the whole picture yet.
All right. Well, thank you so much to the three of you. Thank you, Victor Picard, Ben Compain. Thank you, James Hamilton. Really appreciate your time and sharing your thoughts and work with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
James T. Hamilton is a professor of public policy, economics, and political science and the director of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy. He's the author of All the News That's Fit to Sell, How the Market Transforms Information into News. Ben Compain is director of the Fellows Program at Columbia University Institute for Teleinformation and lecturer at the DeMore McKim School of Business at Northeastern University. He's the author of The Digital Divide and the Internet Upheaval. Victor Picard is a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is co-editor of Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper-Nankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.